This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. If you love listening to this show as much as I love hosting it, I think you'll really like the Medal of Honor podcast, produced in partnership with the Medal of Honor Museum. Each episode talks about a genuine American hero and the actions that led to their receiving our nation's highest award for valor. They're just a few minutes each, so if you're looking for a show to fill time between these Warriors episodes, I think you'll love the Medal of Honor podcast. Search for the Medal of Honor podcast wherever you get your shows. Thanks. I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. In partnership with The Honor Project, we've brought this podcast back at a time when our nation needs these stories more than ever. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for listening, and by doing so, honoring those who have served. Today, we'll hear from Captain Leroy Torres. Torres served in the U.S. Army Reserve for 24 years and spent a year on duty in Balad, Iraq. When he returned home, he discovered he had sustained several physical injuries that were unrelated to combat.
My name is Leroy Torres. I was a captain in the Army Reserve. I served for 23 years until I was medically retired. I was a logistics officer. At first, going way back, or I was medically retired as a captain in Army Reserves, but I was prior service. I mean, my connection with the military goes back to my childhood. Wanted to join the military when I was since elementary. My dad served in the Korean War. My dad was drafted during the Korean War, and I always saw my dad as my hero. He inspired me to be in the military, and that's one thing since I was elementary, I wanted to join the Army and also to work as a state trooper. I had already made up my mind as a child. That's what I wanted to do later on in life, in my careers. I joined at 17. I was still in high school when I joined the military. I joined the Army National Guard. I remember I was already talking to recruiters when I was 16 years old, and I wanted to join as early as I could. So it was a trying season for my mom because since I'm the youngest, my mom had a difficult time, signing off for me since I was underage. But it was something that I wanted to do since a child, and I enlisted. I remember December 9th of 1989. I enlisted in the Army National Guard, and I completed my junior year of high school. And within a week, I was already at Fort Benning, Georgia, at basic training following my junior year. And throughout that time, I of course, finished my basic training. I came back to finish my senior year in high school and still attended my battle assemblies throughout the year. And then as soon as I graduated from high school, within a week again, I was back at Fort Benning for my advanced individual training for infantry school there at Fort Benning, Georgia again. Even serving part-time as in the National Guard, there was still, I didn't feel complete. I wanted to go active duty. So I had a four-year scholarship to University of Texas in Austin. And I finished 1 year, and I was in ROTC. And actually, tell you a quick story. my professor said, that MS professor said, hey, I want you to promise me one thing. I want you to finish college once you finish your active duty. But, you know, I kept bothering them. I want to go active duty. And they were trying to say, well, just wait till you finish your 4 years. But, you know, I was so determined to serve active duty. And March of 1992, I went active duty through December of 1996. I almost went back active duty because I didn't get selected to the State Police Academy. Actually, I applied 3 times to the academy. And that first time I applied, I was still on active duty. Well, I come back home and I didn't get accepted. So what I did, I joined the reserves 2 months after. So February of 1997, I'm already in the reserves because I almost went back active duty because I missed it so much. In April of 97, I was already on a humanitarian mission in Central America, in Belize. I spent 2 weeks down there already because I had my sergeant major knew, like, man, I know you have it. It's in your blood. You're ready to do some active duty time. So he sent me on that humanitarian mission. But throughout that time, through 97 and not until 1998, when I was finally accepted, and at the same time, I kept the promise to my military professor. I went back to school, back to college. I started attending classes while I was working at a correctional facility. And then in 1998, I was accepted to the State Trooper Academy. So throughout my time as a state trooper, they allow me to still attend my battle assembly during those 26 strenuous weeks of training. And fortunately, I ended up stationed back in Corpus Christi, Texas. So this is back to 1999. So throughout these years, I'm serving in the reserves. Well, in 2001, 9/11, I remember I was in El Paso, Texas. And I was visiting my uncle who was terminally ill. And I remember seeing the news that morning. And I tell you what, just my heart rate, I just couldn't wait to get back. And I was already serving as a state trooper. And minutes after the attacks, I received a phone call from my agency that I had to come back to Corpus Christi because since we have the port of Corpus Christi, we were on alert. Our tactical team was placed on alert with the state police. So I tell you what, it was something that just really motivated me, even like me at that time, like, man, I'm ready to go and serve. If you know, duty calls to be activated, I was ready to go. But it was really a moment that I felt that I needed to be with my brothers and sisters who were about to answer the call. But it was definitely a moving time in my life, and whenever I received the news about the 9/11 attacks. I was born in Corpus, so I grew up in Corpus Christi. I was born in Corpus, and actually, I graduated from the DPS Academy in 1999, and that was my first duty station. That was my only duty station. So for 14 years, I served to DPS. I was stationed in Corpus Christi, Texas. I was enlisted at the time. And our commanding general came down. This is back in maybe in 2001. He came down to our unit, and actually my sergeant major approached me and said, "Hey, I want you to take the CG. I want you to be his driver and take him down to the valley, which is to the border, our border units, which is about 2 hours south from Corpus." And one of the first things that the general asked me, he said, I was a staff sergeant. He goes, "Staff sergeant, is there any reason you're not an officer?" And it said, my BC's there, battalion commander. And he goes, "Well, sir, honestly, I just haven't gone back to school." And he says, "Well, I think you'd be a damn good officer." But he told him, "You'd be a damn good officer. And I recommend you go back and do that." And tell you what, that next semester, that's what led me back to start enroll back in college. And once I earned my degree, the 95th Division was actually offering direct commissions at the time. Since I already had my degree, I just went before a board in Oklahoma City, Texas. The board, I passed it with flying colors, and lo and behold, December of 2000, I was granted my commission as a second lieutenant, which is pretty awesome. So, but actually, I ended up at a unit in San Antonio, Texas with 95th Division. I worked in the brigade. I was that my branch was I was AG, Adjutant General Branch, and I was actually working in the, they put me in the Brigade S1, which was to me was an experience working for a full-bore colonel. It was pretty awesome as my first assignment as a first lieutenant. But thankfully, my prior service, it was a very my experience as enlisted was a huge help, you know, in serving. And the way I just approached soldiers and the way we worked together, it was just amazing. As that was my first duty assignment as a commissioned officer. I was deployed to Balad, Iraq in 2007. And I was at that time, I was already a first lieutenant. And initially, I was supposed to go to Afghanistan. I received the phone call. I'll never forget. I was at a coffee shop with my dad. And I had just taken him to the VA clinic. And we're sitting at the coffee shop. And he goes, "Man, son, it's great that you haven't been activated." Not even 5 minutes, my phone rings. And this is my wife. She said, "Hey, your number's been called. So you've been activated. You're going to Afghanistan." So I walk in back in the coffee shop and told my dad, "You won't believe what just happened." And I said, I'm headed east. But my dad says, "You know what? It was just a matter of time." So that this was in 2007, November of 2007, a week before Thanksgiving, I arrived in Balad, Iraq. And I remember stepping off that shuttle, and one of the first questions, and me working in law enforcement, I mean, I ask a lot of questions. I'm very observant. One of the first things, "Man, what is that smell? So what is that stench in the air?" "Oh, that's the burn pits where they burn all the waste." I'm like, "Man, that's like a landfill." I mean, you know, normally people say it's a burn pit. You picture a, you know, not a significant hole or just in the ground where they burn the waste. But when I went and I saw this from a distance, because it was all fenced and it was secured, I said, "Man, this thing is massive." And I remember I began to ask questions as to about the burn pit. "Hey, is this legal? I mean, are they following EPA guidelines?" And of course, there was, "Well, it's not like, in other words, we stay in our lane. That's handled by the contractor, so you don't worry about that." So pretty much, we stayed in our lane. That's what we were told to do. But a burn pit is imagine a landfill size. Balad, Iraq had the largest burn pit in Iraq. It was approximately 10 acres in diameter. So this was this huge pit, landfill, oil, where they would burn all, just imagine, everything that's thrown into the trash, plus medical waste, amputated body parts from the Balad Hospital, was just set ablaze with jet fuel and burned, from plastic bottles to styrofoam, equipment. So you name it, everything that was thrown in the trash was thrown in that pit, doused with JP fuel, and lit on fire. And it burned 24/7. So at times you would see the plume of smoke. I mean, sometimes it'd be darker at times, depending on what they were burning. I was within a mile from this burn pit. And even at that time, I was assigned to a logistics unit. Our work area was even closer to the burn pit. And every time you could even taste that smoke, just this nasty scent in your mouth. And it's the stench. Even at times, if I smell something, I'm like, "Man, it smells like..." It reminds me, it takes me back to that stench. But thinking of a burn pit, I mean, this thing was massive. And I've talked to other folks like, "Man, when you mentioned burn pits, we thought it was just like a, you know, maybe like an 8-foot diameter hole in the ground where they burn waste." No, just imagine, you know, 10 acres of just waste being burned constantly. And this is 24/7. This burn pit was how it was maintained. But you name it, everything that was disposed in. And to know that no telling what all was thrown in there, that included the medical waste from the hospital. I mean, just to think that we were inhaling and ingesting, you know, these toxic fumes, no wonder that it's taking a toll on our bodies. But a month after I was there, December 30th, I still remember because I kept my sick call slip. And I remember going to the troop medical clinic for urgent care. I was having these coughing spells, like dry cough, but like sinus issues. Well, when I saw the physician, he goes, "Yeah, you're dealing with the Iraqi crud." He goes, "Your body's is adjusting to the environment." I'm like, "Okay." I said, "Okay, I'll give it that." So they quarantined me for 72 hours. I had a stomach bug and upper respiratory infection. Put me on CPAC, and I got over it. It took me about 2 weeks. Wanted to get over that, but I noticed that throughout my deployment, I continued to have issues. Especially after I was come back from physical training, we would go run with our section and the stadium they had there in Balat. And I would come back and I would just have this drainage from my sinuses, from my nose, and I'd be taking a shower and it just, this set would just be coming out of my sinuses. And I said, "Man, I don't know. It's like this environment." I said, "I think it's just this taking a toll on us." And so when I told my wife, I said, "Yeah, I was talking to her, she said, "Hey, you sound like you're raspy or like you're coming down with a cold." I said, "No, it's just, this is burping that they rid of all the waste. They burn all this waste. And so I think that's having an effect on us." But that's how my journey started. Then I started having these, waking up with headaches. This is already going back maybe halfway through my deployment. I started having these waking up with headaches, and I noticed that they were getting worse. And then the respiratory infections started. I started having the issues again with my these flare-ups. So I ended up going back to the TMC again, put me on CPAC. The same thing. Well, you're dealing with an upper respiratory infection. I said, "Well, this has already been here for months." And I said, "Is this still the Iraqi crud?" I said, "Well, it's just everybody's different. Your body's just dealing with some changes, but here's some CPAP medication." It was like the same thing over and over. I remember at the end of my deployment, towards the end, I started having like these tremors. My hands were shaking. The thing is, I didn't go with my unit. I was an individual augmentee, so I didn't know anybody in this unit. So during that time, as we connected with my unit, I would ask questions and say, "Hey, are you feeling any issues with me?" "Oh yeah, the hacking cough and issues that they have been dealing with as well." But I noticed that I started having these tremors when it took me about a few months to finally, this just went away, these tremors, when I came back. But I remember coming back and 3 weeks later I was in the emergency room and I had a horrific upper respiratory infection. And one of the first things the doctor asked me, "Hey, have you been around any chemicals? You've been exposed to anything?" I said, "Well, I was in Iraq. I've been back for about 3 weeks. I was around these burn pits where they burn waste." So, and then he goes, "Okay, I'll be right back." The doctor comes back with, he comes back with a mask. And that's when I started kind of flags raising up, but like, you know what, there's something I believe that affected me, from the exposure to these burn pits. And I remember they sent me home and I told my wife, "You know what, I think I'm going to have some issues here in the future. And I'm going to back up a little bit." I remember before I left Balat, Iraq, I was handed a memo from Curtis Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. And it talked about the hazards of burn pits in Balat, Iraq. And when I received that memo, that's when I knew, like, okay, I know where this is going. I said, "This is for your medical record." And I knew, I said, "You know what, it's going to be some issues we're going to deal with." And sure enough, that sixth sense that I always had throughout my deployment, I remember even telling my wife, one thing my wife noticed when I came back home, she says, "I noticed that you sleep with the sheets over your head." I said, "Well, I use that as a kind of as a filter, because I noticed when I would wake up in the mornings and I'd go outside my housing unit, there was this set on the AC unit and I would just wipe it. And it was just like this chalky residue from the, and I said, this is from the burn pit. This is crazy. And everybody, I would ask questions there in my unit or people that I came in contact with. They said, "Oh yeah, it's just from the burn pits. They burn a lot more of the waste at night. So we're inhaling, we're taking this stuff in." Once I received that letter and I came back home and then I ended up in the emergency room, that's when I told my wife, "You know what, this is not going to be good here in the future. Things that I'm going to have to be dealing with." And sure enough, I went back to work. Finally, my my dad was terminally ill when I came back from Iraq. So he was in hospice for 4 months. So I spent a lot of time with my dad before he passed. So I didn't go back to work till, this is back till March of 2009. Because I came back in November of 2008. March of 2009, I'm back at work. And I remember waking up with headaches, having the raspy voice, and that's one thing that I, to this day, I deal with. And my wife's like, it sounds like you have something in your throat, like you always have, like you're congested. I said, well, I'm having sinus issues. But I was played off, because my fear was I did not want to lose my job as a, you know, as a state trooper, because this was my childhood dream, and I didn't want to lose my job. And that was the fear that I always had. And so in our generation, our era in the Army was the Model A, suck it up, drive on. And that's what I did. That's what I did. I would wake up with these excruciating headaches. I was pounding so much Tylenol just before I go to work, just trying to suppress the pain. And then there again, I ended up going to the urgent care with the flare-ups. And again, you're dealing with upper respiratory infection. Here's another Z-Pak. And it's like every couple of weeks, I ended up going to urgent care for treatment. In 2010, August of 2010, I remember I was transferred to the driver's license office. It wasn't a promotion. It was just a take a break from the highway. They put me on Monday through Friday schedule, which was it was good, so I could spend more family, you know, time with family. So it was a good move, you know, for me and my family. So I was working Monday through Friday, but I was working in an office environment while I started having these flare-ups a lot more. Of course, later I found out that building had mold. Years later, I found out. I told my wife, man, it's like I'm always sick when I'm at work. I feel worse and the headaches are worse. Well, August of 2010, my sergeant, he came in the office. He goes, hey, man, you've been coming in with this horrific cough, and you have to work with the public here. People are starting to ask questions. And I said, maybe if you're contagious, and we know you were in Iraq, so you need to address the issue. Because at that time, I had already started, I was missing work. And because of these issues, I was out sick, like with a cold. It's like you seem to always be getting these recurring colds. You need to get checked out. And sure enough, they sent me home. They told me to leave. I said, you need to go home, and you cannot return to work until you have answers. Well, August of 2010 is when our journey began, seeking for answers as to what was going on with me. I began to have shortness of breath. And I'm going to back up a little bit. And the summer of 2009, I was in a foot pursuit. And I remember once I apprehended the suspect, I started having a lot of chest pressure. And I remember I had to take a knee. And I mean, we were a one-man unit, so backup usually took 15 minutes, you know. So by the time backup arrived, I had the guy in custody. And I remember the officers that backed me up, because, man, are you okay? I said, man, I don't know. I feel lightheaded. I thought I was having a stroke. I just felt a lot of pressure in my chest. It took me, my goodness, probably maybe 15, 20 minutes. I just had to sit it out for a little while. And that's when I noticed, like, there's something wrong. Said something's going on with my lungs. I just couldn't put my finger on it. I mean, we went to Brooke Armor Medical Center, went to Wilford Hall Medical Center in San Antonio, went to Audie Murphy VA Hospital. And they looked at me like, man, maybe it's in my head. And I remember going to Baylor University Hospital in Houston. And the doctor gave me psych meds, and he patched my back. He goes, this is going to help you relax. And that's when I walked out of the office. And at this time, I'm already frustrated because we couldn't find answers. And I took that piece of paper and I balled it up. And I told my wife, you know what, let's go. You know, we're not getting nowhere with finding answers to what's wrong with me, because they couldn't pinpoint. My pulmonary function tests were normal. And at that time, my wife's already connecting with families on social media. And met with these families that were also, she started researching about burn pits. And sure enough, she connected with families. We connected with Dr. Robert Miller out of Nashville, Tennessee, at Vanderbilt University Hospital. Well, Dr. Miller was already doing research for years. He was seeing soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division that had been exposed to the sulfur fires in Iraq and also to burn pits. And he had already done like so many, maybe like 49 lung biopsies at the time. And I think all of them but two were all positive for constrictive bronchitis. And when my wife found Dr. Miller, I said, you know what, we're going to go see Dr. Miller. And of course, we go to the VA. Thankfully, Dr. Figueroa at the time, he was in Iraq, so he knew what I was talking about. But as far as a lot of other physicians, like, no, maybe it's anxiety, or maybe I was developing asthma, just everything else, but nothing to do with burn pit exposure. Well, in the fall of 2010, this is around maybe September of 2010, the VA, I finally get approved to go to the War-Related Illness and Injury Center in Washington, D.C. So they admit me to the hospital. I'm in there for 4 days. And upon my discharge, the chief pulmonologist, their findings were, you do have shortness of breath, but it's unknown etiology. So my wife, at that time, has already connected with families. She's aware that some veterans have already passed away from unexplained, either from different types of cancers, leukemia, and which the family is, and this has to be connected to burn pit exposure. Well, at that time, she asked the doctor, well, I want a lung biopsy. I want you for y'all to do a lung biopsy on my husband because he needs answers. He can't go back to work until we have answers. And of course, their response, well, we're not equipped to do biopsies. It's one thing that we cannot, we don't have the resources to do that here at this facility. I said, but you're the War-Related Illness Injury Study Center. You're supposed to be capable of doing that. Of course, so that was another door closed for us. And at that time, my wife had already been talking to Dr. Robert Miller at Vanderbilt University Hospital. And November 16th of 2010, I was already, that's when I had my lung biopsy there at the Vanderbilt Hospital. And I'm going to back up a little bit. Before, on our initial visit, he goes, I'm not going to recommend the biopsy because just from your symptoms and the CT scan did show air trapping on your lower lobes of your lungs, I could pretty much guarantee that you have constrictive bronchitis. But because you're telling me that your job needs answers and we'll have to move because it's an invasive procedure, it's painful. And I'll tell you what, it took a year for me to recover from that lung biopsy. But I couldn't lay on my right side for a year because of the, they took in three areas. Of course, one was for the chest tube, but they cut me in two other areas and they took a small wedge in my lower lobe. And on my lower lobe of my lung, and that's when they discovered that when the surgeon walked in the next day, and I came to, and he showed me the picture of my lungs, and he asked me, and I said, "Are you a smoker, son?" I said, "No, sir, I never smoked in my life." And he showed me the lungs, like I could see like inflammation, and the way he was explaining to me, he goes, "You have periorbronchial fibrosis, you have constrictive bronchitis." But yeah, you have a lung injury, and this is from exposure, toxic exposure. And I remember before I was full into the operating room, my wife was, her words to me is, you know what, I'm going to make you a promise. It says, I'm going to fight for you. It says, no matter what the outcome is. And she said, and she was crying to that, no matter what the outcome is, I'm going to fight for you because you're not going to be the last one that's going to go through this. It's going to be many more. And, you know, going back over a decade, she kept her promise. But that was difficult for me to accept because I already knew the first thing I thought about, I'm going to lose my job. You know, that was one of the first things that I thought. And I said, this is my childhood dream. So I started, you know, having a lot of very difficult season in my life once knowing that it was when the doctors explained to me, this is a permanent condition, it's irreversible, and that even it may progress later in life. So, of course, we come back home. Actually, we met a family in Nashville, or Staff Sergeant Ox, Steve Ox. He actually, he was with the 101st and he passed away around 2008. But she, Stacey Pennington, had already been advocating for her brother regarding burn pit exposure, toxic exposure. Well, we connected with that family. Well, they took us in for the 2 weeks that I was there because I couldn't fly back because the doctors were afraid that my lung may collapse. So I had to have family. They traveled to Tennessee and picked me up and then drove me back. But we were there for 2 weeks. So I didn't get back home till actually we spent Thanksgiving on the road on 2010, Thanksgiving of 2010, which was difficult because we couldn't see our kids. Finally made it back home. And this was a time that I was afraid to talk to my agency because I knew that they were going to just kind of, they're going to secure my job at that time. And sure enough, I come back home. You know, I talk to my supervisor, say, I have a permanent condition. I have a lung injury associated because of burn pit exposure, toxic exposure. So I need a job accommodation. I said, I can't come back to work. I can't fulfill my duties. Well, then my service captain comes back and says, well, let's see what we can do for you. But this is like end of 2010. I go back to work 2011. I'm put on light duty. Well, it was just temporary. I go through 2011. I start missing work again. The headaches get worse. I remember one time I was there at the office and I was in so much pain that I had to go and check myself in at the VA clinic. And they actually, as soon as I get there, they put me on oxygen and they didn't know what to say. I'm sorry, but we don't know what to do for you. So that's when our journey started also with the headaches. As of now, I have over 400 medical visits. Since I've been back, and the routine for me, that for me to deal with my headaches, I was put on IV meds and oxygen, and they would keep me for a few hours. Once the headaches would diminish, I would be discharged, and here's some pain medication, and that was my life with the headaches for 10 years.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit, or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
I remember in 2018, I was diagnosed with toxic encephalopathy, which is a toxic brain injury. And throughout this time, I told my wife, and I don't know what else to do anymore because we can't get answers. But we traveled to Colorado to have a Q-spec scan, and that's where they discovered this brain injury. And throughout this time, I noticed that I started having trouble with my short-term memory, my cognitive abilities. I began to have issues. I would be talking to somebody and I would lose my train of thought, and it was very frustrating because throughout this day, I struggle with it, but I've learned to cope. And that's why I wear this oxygen, because it's my rescue med for the headaches. This is what alleviates the headaches. And who would have thought that all I needed was some oxygen to alleviate the headaches? So this is what if I use it like I'm supposed to, it keeps me out of the, you know, having to go to the emergency rooms and those visits. But, you know, that was a long 10 years of waiting for answers, because the whole time I was given medication for migraine headaches. And all this time I had a toxic brain injury. So this was something that I dealt with for a long time. You know, here recently, lately, I've been having a lot of GI issues. I've been having GI bleeds. I was in the hospital in January, this past January, for pancreatitis. Well, they say my pancreatitis was not functioning. 4 days later, it's back to normal. So the doctor's like, man, this is a mystery. I've been having H. pylori infections for the last 2 years. I've been on so much treatment. I've been on so many antibiotics that it doesn't treat it. So I'm just waiting to go to Mayo Clinic to see if they can help. But that's I've been dealing with these issues for 10 years, these mysterious GI bleeds. Burpees 360 inception came about after our personal experience with the delay and denial issue, not only from not receiving the specialized healthcare or even, specialized healthcare, but also the challenge with my job loss. And when my wife, when she told me that as the equipment to operate room, made me that promise, she began connecting with families. She created a website. I mean, this is from our kitchen at our home. She created a website, went to the Vista Print, created a website, just printed some brochures. I mean, this goes back in 2010. I remember being discharged from that war-related illness and injuries study center, and we were wheeling our luggage down the hallways of Congress following my discharge, and she was handing out brochures that she had printed about talking about burn pits, what a burn pit is. So this goes back to 2010. And I say it's passion driven that we made it this far. But when you get a group of committed families and brothers and sisters that you served along with, and that I've lost some great brothers and sisters because of the illnesses, that they were no longer here. And that was one of the, as I explained to some reporters the day of their passing of the PACT Act, that it was bittersweet because those that walked the hallways of Congress with us were no longer here. They passed away because of these illnesses. But knowing that Burpees 360 and throughout the years, how this started just from our home kitchen, how it became an advocacy group. And I remember in 2011, there was a Virginia Quarterly Review. Malcolm Garcia came and he did a story on us and our journey. I mean, this is like, he goes, man, this is grassroots. I said, how it just, looking back, how this started and how far that we have come. But knowing that because of the delay and denial, we got a group of families that came together and we begin to advocate. And we begin to ask to networking with researchers, with Dr. Miller, began to work with him, with Dr. Anthony Zema, who had already been doing research. But it was connecting families with those physicians. My mission was, I didn't want these fellow veterans to go through what I went through not having answers, through having doors shut in their face, or being told, hey, go and build momentum, then come back. But there were so many doors that were closed throughout the years. I remember in 2017, we were at the in D.C. We had our first congressional briefing. We were briefing staffers what burn pits are on awareness. And still, like, well, we would put the content was put out there, but it's like no sound bites. Everything was shut down. Nobody was listening. Well, in looking back, that persistence, and when you're passionate about something and you drive the key element to stick, you know, to your promise. And there's promises that I made. I made a promise to my Sergeant Major, who passed away in 2014, Sergeant Major Vella. And I remember, and these promises like that, whenever I struggled with my health, that I said, you know what, I remember his voice. Sir, his words to me said, sir, you're going to be our voice when we're no longer here. Just don't give up in this fight, because it's going to be a tough fight, but don't give up, because you're going to be our voice when we are no longer here. So it was those moments that inspired me to continue my fight, to continue the advocacy throughout the years. But in seeing how this came about here, to the passing of the PACT Act, how much work and effort but that democracy works, that it works. And when you get a group of veterans, I mean, I believe those values that you were taught in the military, like the army, the soldier street, there's two lines that always stick to me. Says, I will never accept defeat. I will never quit. And those two lines, I tell my wife, you know what, till the good Lord calls me, or, you know, as long as I wake up with a breath. And there's times that I, you know, like yesterday, I was having a tough day yesterday with the headaches. I was having a difficult day, but I tell my wife, and I wake up every day, I regroup and drive on, continue to press on this issue and bring the continued awareness for those that need the help. But here a few days ago, there was a veteran that shared a testimonial where he was so grateful. He goes, I'm so glad to see this PACT Act. He said, I was finally granted my VA compensation. So just for his privacy, you know, the group, the advocacy group, they sent us a video, but it was awesome to hear from this one veteran. And one thing he said, he goes, well, now I don't have to worry if I pass, that my children will be taken care of. So that brought a lot of peace to me, that so many will be helped now that have been struggling, like I struggled for over these 10 years. Thankfully, my VA case was finally approved after a couple of years, but because the Army did their own investigation, the Army did a line of duty investigation, and it was revealed that due to an instrumentality of war, that they discovered that my lung injury was due to burn pit exposure. Now, if it had not been for that, you know, who knows how long it would have taken for me to get that approval. But it's been so much peace and this joy that now these veterans are not left out there in the cold, that now they can submit their claims and get the help that they need. Staff Sergeant Will Thompson, double lung transplant survivor. We worked together, and he was part of the panel of that congressional briefing in 2017. Him and his family walked the hallways of Congress in 2017. In 2018, he was a great brother. And he, no matter in what condition he was in, he said, hey, brother, if I can speak, I'm gonna represent Burn Pit 360 and, you know, our fellow brothers and sisters. And it's just this, man, he just had this heart of gold. But Staff Sergeant Will Thompson, rest in peace. You know, unfortunately, he passed away here December of last year. But just knowing, at the PACT Act, once the first vote, when the Senate, it passed the Senate the first time, I remember going to that press conference, and I had his wife, Suzanne, sent me a real nice card, a thank you card, and had his picture, and actually had that on my binder and on my smart book that I carry with me. And I was sharing with people, and I said, man, this is why we are here today, for people like my brother, Staff Sergeant Will Thompson, who's no longer here. But you know what? His legacy lives on because he fought so hard for us. His last testimony that he gave to the Veterans Committee there in Congress, he had to Zoom because he was not doing well. But he still said, you know what? I'll still testify. And he gave a statement. So it's people like Staff Sergeant Thompson. And I didn't get to meet Staff First Class Keith Robinson, but I met his wife, you know, and his daughter. And oh my God, his mother-in-law, Susan, just amazing advocate. Actually, I met her in 2017, also at the congressional briefing. That's when we first met. Susan, it was just amazing to connect. But working all these years, these past, you know, 5 years with those advocates, have just made a tremendous impact in our lives. Knowing that when you put your thoughts together, and when you come together with this passion, that no matter how many doors close on you, you know, like when the second vote, when it didn't pass, that it was a moment that we were going to quit. We had veterans out there. Actually, my wife stood out there at the Capitol steps for 5 days. She was out there with you know, during that fire watch, veterans that came together. You know, we have Tim Jensen from Grunstyle, who was out there and said, man, we're gonna stand with you, we're gonna stand united. And peacefully, they advocated out there and protesting and just showing the support. Actually, all the signs that they had out there they gave them to my wife so we can bring back it as and to have them as memorabilia from that pack deck, from the passing and all those days that they spent out there in the Capitol. But just seeing the potential that was there, that we were victorious and we didn't give up on that fight.
That was Captain Leroy Torres. To learn more about him and Burn Pits 360, visit burnpits360.org. Thanks for listening to Warriors in Their Own Words. If you have any feedback, please email the team at kharbaugh@evergreenpodcasts.com. We're always looking to improve the show. For updates and more, follow us on Twitter at @team_Harbaugh. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review. Warriors in Their Own Words is a production of Evergreen Podcasts in partnership with The Honor Project. Our producer is Declan Roars. Bridget Coyne is our production director, and Sean Ruhlhoffman is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Evergreen executive producers Joan Andrews, Michael DeAloya, and David Moss. I'm Ken Harbaugh, and this is Warriors in Their Own Words.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.